tendency is to believe that we are the anomaly. And we believe that in our success, we believe that in our failure, we believe that in our oddities, but that which is most personal is most universal.
Hey folks, this is Abe Shreve. Welcome to the Choose Difficult podcast. The path to success is not easy, and here we explore the stories of those who choose difficult and change the world they live in. Today we're coming to you from beautiful Ogden, Utah, and I'm excited to introduce you to Dr. Matt Townsend. Now, Matt and I have been friends for quite a long time. Matt is a relationship communication expert. He's written an incredible book called Starve Stuff. He is absolutely one of the most gifted and talented speakers and content creators that I've ever met. Matt's history of work experience is really fascinating. He got his start with Stephen Covey and that organization, where he traveled all over the world working with Fortune 500 leaders all the way down to even smaller businesses. But he really has found his passion in helping people in their relationships. He is someone that I've brought in to speak to groups that I'm working with frequency. And what he teaches in his book, Starve Stuff, makes up one of the core foundational philosophies in my coaching and leadership philosophy. I consider Matt an indispensable leader in my life, and I'm excited to introduce you to him today. Matt didn't get his start as a world-renowned author and speaker. He got his start on the way to becoming a relationship expert when his parents got divorced.
My parents divorced when I was 8. And a lot of times that sounds like that was horrific and horrible. The funny thing is I didn't know better. But I did know that my friends' parents weren't divorcing. But I also am grateful that I got to go through what I went through because it taught me a bunch. And it got me focused very young on relationships, on life, on people. And I think I am today what I am because of that experience. But what happened when they divorced, I got the blessing, I guess, of being able to go every day to my dad's office. So I would go to school and then my dad would pick me up from school and I would go work with my dad. So from a very young age, probably 8 on, 9 on, I was going to work every day after school. In the summers, I'd work with him. So I watched business. I watched small business, and I learned very young. I thought in my head, I never want to own a business. While I was kind of growing up, I didn't know what I wanted to do. My dad kept saying, maybe get into business. Then I married into a family where everybody was, they were all doctors. So I thought, hey, maybe I'll just be a doctor. And then I tried a little stint as an emergency medical technician and realized right then, yeah, don't want to do that. Don't have the brains for that. So eventually became a journalist. Thought that would be really fun. When I was getting my master's degree, I was attracted to get a master's in conflict resolution, and because I really wanted to learn how to handle conflict that my parents couldn't handle. So I got a master's in that and then started working for Franklin Covey Company, traveling around the country, working with executives, and got really focused on creating content for what would be called, in Covey's language, the public victory. Habits 4, 5, 6, and 7, I guess. And so anyway, that's how I got started. And from that, eventually did my own coaching program. Literally started as a mediator, helping couples divorce. Hated every minute of that. But then I realized that if we teach them some skills, they can talk. And so I had divorcing couples that started communicating really well. And then I thought about 2 years in, why are we divorcing anybody? And that's when I started to write my book, my program, and have never done any more mediation since then.
One of the things that's really interesting to me, and Matt and I have spoke about many times, is that we will get help in all kinds of areas of our lives. We'll get help in finances. We'll have a fitness trainer help us get into shape, and then the word that we'll use for the rest of our lives, back into shape, as if that's supposed to mean something important. But for some reason, the relationship that means the very most to us, the one that has the most at risk, and consequently the one that we have the most to gain, we think should just run on autopilot. We fell in love once, and that means forever it should just be great. And part of what Matt discovered as he was working through the mediation process with people is they lacked skill. They lacked language. They lacked a methodology for how to understand the other person. And once they were taught skills and given a formula that they could use, it was fascinating to see people fall back into love with each other. Now, one of the things you're going to notice as you listen to Matt is he's funny. And sometimes he's funny just because he has a quick wit. But a lot of times I find myself laughing because it's that feeling of, certainly he is only talking about me. That's when you know someone is really hitting a universal truth.
Part of the idea behind the mediation is I already had a degree in conflict resolution. So basically all the dialogue theory. And I actually had a really interesting thing. In fact, here's an example of it right here. This is a talking stick. And I remember at Franklin Covey, we would teach communication skills, teaching about a talking stick. And the Native Americans, whoever had the stick, had the voice, and they could share their opinion. And but what I learned is that it's great to teach a theory, but I knew that most of the people that I was teaching with had never sat down with a couple that hated each other and got them to talk. So I always knew I had an Achilles heel there where I had never done it. And I knew I couldn't relax until I did it, until I could sit down with people that full on hated each other and wanted to seriously destroy each other and create dialogue. And so that's where, after having all these skills and tools, I saw that there was a friend that was owning a mediation company, went and talked to him, asked if I could come work with him, and I started mediating. And that's where I learned to actually do the mediation. But more importantly, that's where I could start using these principles with people in high conflict. And did that for about 2 years just to start, but very quickly realized that a lot of these people don't want a divorce if they could just talk. And that's where we started teaching them the skills. Then it's what we talk about. See, but what you'll see is most of the people end up creating so much smoke that, and we create such disturbance in the conversation, and that it always traps us. And once the smoke's in the room, everyone either starts swinging or they start bailing. And a lot of times, once you can keep the smoke out of the room, you can start to clear some pretty big things in your life. Not everything's fixable, but it also is, it doesn't have to be complicating. It doesn't have to get harder and worse and more irritating. Some of the great researchers in marriage and family, like John Gottman and others, talk about the fact that about 69% of conflict in marriage is never going to be resolved. It's not resolvable. Some of it's just the fact you grew up poor. And because you grew up poor, you might be more worried about money. So that I may not ever change in you. And I may not ever change your, you may not ever change your spouse's heart disease. You can't change everything. And you can't change the fact that your spouse's parents divorced. And you can't change that they fought for 30 years as a family. So fighting is natural. What you can change, though, is how you respond to it, how you deal with it, how you manage it. And then you can take good skills or healthier skills and manage the other, 30%.
One of the things that Matt talks about is he asked the question, what's the leading cause of death in a house fire? And oftentimes you get people that will say, well, people burn to death. But it really isn't that. It's smoke inhalation. So then he asked the question, how do you get rid of the smoke? And it's amazing how often the answer is, well, you open a window. But we all know what happens when you add oxygen to a fire. So really, the only way to get rid of the smoke is to put out the fire. The fire is the source, isn't it? And when you hear Matt talking about there's all this smoke in the room, look, smoke is the killer. It is the thing that chokes out life. But it isn't the source of the conflict. And when we have conflict in our most important relationships and we don't know how to resolve it, have you ever noticed that everything else in life is more difficult? And I think kind of universally true is this feeling that comes over a couple that doesn't seem to be getting along anymore. This feeling of, this is unique to us. No one else could possibly understand what we're experiencing. Nobody else has been through this.
Our tendency is to believe that we are the anomaly. And we believe that in our success. We believe that in our failure. We believe that in our oddities, in our pains. But that which is most personal is most universal. The biggest fear any human has is probably a universal fear. And it's probably four basic fears, usually. It's, am I lovable? Am I capable? Do I belong? And am I safe? And when we understand that pretty much every human on earth is questioning lovability, capability, belonging, and safety, then you can start to pretty quickly cut through all the other stuff. And I call it the stuff because, I've seen people say they want a divorce over lettuce. I've seen people say they want a divorce over a purse. And what's funny is when you get in and start cutting it down to its most basic elemental part, it is really nothing about lettuce or a purse. It's always about lovable, capable, belonging, and safe. Those are four feelings we can't avoid. And when we can't avoid them and we're not feeling that feeling, it reacts to us and our fight or flight kicks in. And then we just go off of nature, by the way, which is also natural, right? So part of the hardest thing we're trying to stop with people is the most natural thing that they do. And by the way, the only way to override it would be to almost do something unnatural and get into the higher part of their brain, get into their higher purpose, and which, by the way, is weirdly easier, believe it or not, in a divorce setting. Like the minute a couple is actually divorcing, that's one thing. But the minute we're talking about what's best for their kids long term is another thing. In fact, when I started doing coaching, I would always ask the couples to bring me a picture of their family. And I'd keep it in my file. And every time we'd sit down with them and just start coaching, I'd always pull the picture out and I'd set it on the table. And that would always be sitting there. Because the great universal is I could always go back to the picture. And I'm like, is this what we're doing here? Is this really best for them? So universality is really powerful, right? And it also normalizes, right? So typical therapy 101 is normalize, normalize, normalize. And when you normalize behavior, it kind of turns you into the hero of your own life. You now can normally take it over. Anxiety is normal, right? So if you just, if you're a child going to school for the first time, it's normal to be anxious. If you're about to shoot the free throw to win the game, it's normal to feel anxious. If you have stage fright, it's normal. So sometimes what our brain tends to do is it tries to pull us to these extremes. And then in the extreme, it can justify the extreme. It can justify extreme behavior, extreme reactivity. But when we normalize and we kind of just make it normal for you to feel that way because you're a high sensitive or you're more anxious or you only learned how to fight this way or talk this way, that's normal for your behavior. Then what we can do is kind of pull people back more to the normal middle. So what are the good behaviors of normal conversations instead of what are the extreme behaviors of abnormal situations? I'm trying every way I can to get them to the center. Not all behaviors are normal, but all behaviors are normal for where the person's coming from. If you're a bipolar schizophrenic, there are normal behaviors for bipolar schizophrenics that are in their average norm of behavior. And so some of this is just trying to figure out you and then get everything we can to the middle and then start, by the way, by having conversations. That's how we're going to change meaning. All meaning in the world is changed through conversation, through interaction. We don't know something without interacting on it. So if we can get you to interact in a healthier way, we can create healthier meaning and healthier change.
Now, some of you listening, you're identifying with this and it makes a lot of sense, but you're thinking that is logical and it makes perfect sense. But my partner is not rational. They're illogical. Have you ever tried to rationalize with someone who's irrational? We are painting them with a brush based on our perspective and our experience with them. But there is neuroscience that explains why a person acts so intensely in tense moments. And it starts with a part of the brain called the amygdala.
Universally, we all have an amygdala, a fight or flight mechanism in our brain. I call it the reptilian kind of brain. I don't call it. Everybody kind of calls it the reptilian brain. And it's the most base brain. So pretty much every animal evolved with an amygdala, this reptilian fight or flight brain. All physiological stimuli, all sensory data goes through the amygdala. And what it's designed to do is very quickly give you a script, a reactive script to save your life instantly. And it was designed, right, so you wouldn't be eaten by a mountain lion. It was designed so the saber-toothed tiger wouldn't get you, which is powerfully good, right? That's really good. You should react. There's perfect normal times to react. The dilemma is that when we're sitting in our marriage and having a conflict with our spouse and she's like, so are we paying taxes this year? And you're like, what? Of course we're we always pay taxes. Well, didn't last year we didn't. No, we did. Well, we paid them late, right? Yeah, but we still paid them. All of a sudden, when you feel a threat, as simple as a question from your wife, now you're not going to this higher brain, you're going to your fight or flight brain. And the fight or flight brain was never designed to create a long-term relationship. The fight or flight brain was designed to basically eat someone mate with somebody or run from somebody. And whenever I say that, a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, that sounds like my husband. And it might be true, right? Because a lot of men, we have more neurons tied to fight or flight. And some of that's, you know, just evolution. But the dilemma that I see when we're coaching people is, how do I teach somebody to override a physiological life or death saving part of their brain? It's totally doable. In fact, it's funny because when the amygdala fires, you have about 400th of a second until the same information gets to the prefrontal cortex, the higher brain, the relating brain. But that 4 seconds will make or break you, because if you don't choose wisely to slow it down, then you're going to be immediately flooded by chemistry. Blood leaves your brains, goes to your extremities, and you're wired for fight. In fact, I had a guy on my radio show once that said, it takes like, I think he said 14,000 years to evolve a new trait. So we're kind of in trouble on this amygdala thing, because it's not going to, you know, I think years and years and years of us taking care of our kids as men and being there and slowing down this amygdala, I think we will evolve new traits. But until then, we've got to probably find other healthier ways to do it. The other thing, by the way, the amygdala, once it fires that we don't feel safe or that she's hurting me with this questioning, we go to the emotional pain and physical pain are virtually in the exact same space in the brain. So our brain doesn't distinguish pain. Pain is pain is pain is pain. But we really live in one of the safest times in history. We live in one of the healthiest times in history. And yet we fight with our partner like she's, you know, out to get us, or they're out to get us. So we've got to turn off this amygdala. And what's amazing is the people you know in your life that you trust that have the most character are usually the ones that have the most control over that fight or flight brain.
Matt once explained to me that grandma gave us all really terrible advice. Now, of course, the advice I'm referencing is that old adage that the key to a happy marriage is to never go to bed angry. But the challenge of that is that we're going to pick the time of the day that we have the least amount of mental and emotional resources. We're the most likely to be triggered in the fight or flight center of our brain. We're most prepared for conflict, and we're going to just stay committed to staying up and in this conflict through the night. It's the reason why, if you've ever had this experience, I haven't, but others have, where you have a fight with your spouse at night and you wake up the next day and you're committed to the conflict, but you don't remember what started it. And if she could just give you the prompt, then you could jump right back into the conflict. You just don't remember where it was. It's because soon we're not trying to work out an issue. We're fighting to fight, because that's where we are in the brain. Now, while we're talking about this in more intimate relationships, like a spouse or a partner, I want you to think about the way we respond to others at work and others out in the world. There are triggers and there are things that cause us to respond in the amygdala. And when we do, we are not inviting logic and reason and understanding. We're inviting trouble.
Once that your brain starts to fire, it's kind of over, because the adrenal glands have shot their load and wad, and it's all out there now. And they found that adrenaline stays in your system for 24 hours. So once the amygdala starts to fire, if you can't turn it around in about 6 seconds, you will be flooded. And there's levels of flooding, right? But some levels can be reversed within a few minutes. You can at least move to kind of more neutral zone, but you will still have the effects of adrenaline in your system for 24 hours. Which is why some people can't move on, right? They can't get over stuff. And if you think about that, that's how your body would be wired. Don't ever forget the mountain lion lives over here. Don't ever forget that. And so remember, too, that all memories are stored emotionally. So the more emotional our brain can make a moment, the more we will remember it. And by remembering it, it doesn't mean in a healthy way. We've now remembered the script. So we'll just keep playing the script. That is, by the way, the bad side of having a memory is that we keep replaying scripts. So there is a power to just trying not to go by your memory. There is a power to try to like live every moment in a new way so that you can actually create something new. That very question, what can I do, is a really brilliant way to move from your amygdala to your high brain. Anytime you ask a self-reflective question, like that's healthy, it will move you to your high brain. Anytime you ask kind of a reactive question, like, why is this happening? What happened last time? What did I do last time to get out of this? That's just going to keep you in the amygdala. But you could ask other questions like, what do I want most here? What is this person really trying to say? Will any of this matter in 1,000 years or 5 years or 10 years? And anything that you do that is effectively a high brain reflective question will immediately move you to the high brain and kind of literally circumvent, hijack the fight or flight reaction.
Now, I cannot help but give a personal example here. My wife's going to listen to this and that's going to be trouble. There was this Sunday, we have all the kids to get ready for church so that we can all go for church. And I woke up early because sometimes I just don't sleep. But that day, instead of doing something else, I was a model husband. I got the kids up. I got them ready. We were prepared. And when my wife came out, who I let sleep a little longer, when she came out, I said, the kids are ready and everything is set. And she looked at me and said, great, now you go get ready. And I had this feeling of, how dare you? Do you not see that I have just made life better in every single way? I was mad and I kind of like a little baby. I went and got in the shower and I remembered this tactic that Matt, this skill, this tool that Matt gave us called the respecting question. And I started asking, well, why would a beautiful, wonderful, caring, loving, you know, best friend of mine respond that way? And as I started to explore answers to that, one of them was, because we're never on time to church and this week we have a shot. See, in the absence of going there in my brain, I'm upset because she didn't give me the response that I thought I wanted, which was to fall into my arms and weep at this incredible contribution. When the truth is, she sees we could do this. And by the way, I wasn't ready for church. But that's a silly little example, but I hope it shines a light on how powerful it is and how important it is to be in the right brain at the right moment when you're working with people.
I just found that a lot of couples needed a protocol. They needed something that in the middle of the fight or flight, we needed to know that we could ask ourselves a question. And because what we tend to do is we tend to ask a reactive question that immediately takes us down what I call the low road, right? And we start reacting negatively, feeling negatively. I wanted to find a question we could ask that would cue the data to at least neutral or positive. And the way I found to do that is you ask yourself. So if somebody was supposed to help you with a business idea and you're supposed to meet at 5 o'clock and they didn't show up, instead of thinking, what an idiot, what a jerk, and going down the low road, you could stop, you could pause, and you could just ask yourself, why would I, and then you just insert 5 positive words. Why would a caring, smart, hardworking, productive best friend not show up for me when he said he would? What the question does is it fuse your answer positive. Our fight or flight brain tends to skew the answers negative. And our fight or flight brain wants it to be negative, so we're justified to react and respond. That's called negative interpretation. So what we're trying to do with the respecting question is try to skew the question more neutral or more healthy. And then usually what you'll find out is most people aren't trying to mess you over. Most people, in fact, one of my favorite quotes in the stuff we teach is from Napoleon that says, never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by incompetency. You don't need to attribute maliciousness to anyone's behavior when it's just as adequately explained by stupidity or incompetency. And statistically, you're much more likely to just be dealing with an incompetent or with somebody in their weakest area instead of somebody that's really out to get you. Most people don't care about you enough to chase you. Most people are just in survival mode trying to deal with all their flaws and frailties. And the terms are fair to both, right? So if you tend to be the fighter, they're fair to you. If you tend to be the flighter, they're fair to you. So it actually levels the playing field. You know what else? It dramatically slows down the conversation. And that's one of the big goals in conflict is if we can slow it down, we have a huge advantage. It's like when you're pulling your car into the garage, you tend to do it slowly. You don't usually just speed in there. Because we want accuracy. So one of the things I've just found is if I slow it down, it is amazing. And then what you also do is you pretty much compel the people in the conversation to have to be in their higher brain. And one of the best ways to do that is just reflective listening. By having to reflect what you're saying, means I have to actually see it, hear it, feel it on various levels, content levels, feeling levels, and what I call the starved level. Once I can see it and reflect it back for you, it's amazing how naturally you're influenced by it or more influenced by it. Instead of the typical preparing my retort and my response kind of thing.
When I was growing up, my mother coined a phrase she called interpretive listening. And essentially, she would joke with us and say, if you really cared, you'd know what I was thinking. Which I think is really funny now that I'm an adult and I get that. But the idea behind it is that we attach meaning to all kinds of things that haven't earned that particular meaning. So if you take the example that I gave earlier of my wife as I was getting the kids ready for church, in my mind I'm thinking, you don't appreciate me. You're not grateful for me. When the truth was, she just wanted to get to church. But you can see how quickly you can become derailed with a person when you start reacting to the story that you've made up. Matt calls this scripting. He calls these our scripts.
60% of us have past scripts and triggers where we learned young that we weren't lovable, capable, belonging, and safe. And because we weren't capable and belonging and safe, we built a script. And we didn't build the script like an adult 50-year-old person. We built it like a reactive 14-year-old person. And we still pull that script out. I had a client come and see me once that he didn't feel like he belonged with his family. They didn't need him. And he didn't feel capable there. And his wife kind of even said so. And whenever he'd say something, nobody listened to him. But he had built a business worth about $100 million. Highly successful. And as we were sitting there talking, I asked him, so what do you feel when you say that you don't belong, when you say that you're not capable of this, what's your earliest memory of feeling that way in life, not in the marriage or with the kids? And he got a little teary and he said, I was a 15-year-old baseball player. I had always made the baseball team. And at 15, I tried out for my sophomore baseball team and I didn't make the team. It was the first time in my life with all my friends. They all made it. And I felt like I was just as good as all of them. But I didn't make the team. And right then was the first time I knew I didn't belong. And I wasn't capable. And I asked, what did you do? And he's like, I just detached. Right then, he said, I intentionally detached. And I didn't hang out with him anymore. We didn't play ball together. We didn't do anything like that. He said, I eventually quit going to school, quit high school, got my GED, went to college, got a great degree, got another master's. And what he did was, then he said, I built a company. And he said, I built a company where I would always belong, where everyone would always need me. So literally, he did everything in the company and everything had to go through him in the company. And every time he would go home and didn't belong, he would just leave the kitchen and go into his office, shut the doors, and just belong. Always detached. And that was the script he created, right? And so, and by the way, he wasn't doing that like a brilliant CEO of a $100 million company. He was doing that like a 15-year-old boy that didn't make the baseball team. And every single one of us, when we don't have our basic needs met, our fight or flight scripts turn on, and we usually end up becoming one of two things, really anxiously controlling or anxiously avoidant, or a little bit of both.
My hope is that we're all starting to understand better that the reactions that we are having, that the feelings that we are having may not represent all the possibilities. And my experience has been that in the presence of the right process, the issue will evaporate. So if you take a couple that's really at odds, maybe this has even happened to you, they are not getting along. And finally, one of them summons the ability to say, hey, I think I caused this. I'm sorry. I think this was me. That fast, the other one says, no, I think it was me. I mean, minutes earlier, they wanted you found guilty and hung in the public square. But now they're like, no, I think it's me. It's not just you, that fast. And the reason for that is we want to be connected. But these past scripts and dealing with each other in the reactive brain sets us up for failure. Remember when we talked about the smoke? Well, how do you get rid of the smoke?
As I would sit with couples, I would always see every time they just start creating smoke. And once I could see the smoke generating through fight or flight, their amygdalas were firing. I started to see that those universal needs weren't being met. So STARVED is an acronym that stands for seven basic needs of all humans. So this is what makes us most universal. Every human has safety issues. We need to feel safe. physically safe so we're not going to be harmed, socially safe so we won't be embarrassed, emotionally safe so we can share what's in our heart, financially safe so we have enough money, spiritually safe so we have the same value system. So we have to have safety. When we don't have safety, think about it. If you're not safe with somebody, how do you communicate? You don't, or you fight. So we have to have safety. Second basic need is trust. We have to trust each other. To trust, I teach you have to trust two things. I have to trust your character, so you're honest and decent, and you have to trust your competency, so you know what you're doing. It's not enough to just have a really awesome neighbor and bring them into your business, but they're clueless. It's not enough. To trust your neighbor that's going to be in your business, they got to have character and competency. Third basic need is appreciation. Everyone wants to be appreciated differently. Some want, I use senses. So some of us are hearers. We need to hear we're awesome. Some are seers. They need to see it. Some need touch. Don't do that. You're a business person. Stay away from touching. Some need just time. They're sensors. They want your time and your attention, your focus. So everyone wants to be appreciated differently. Everybody wants respect. Everybody wants to be revered, right? They want to be seen as something that's important. So you'll listen to my opinions. You'll take my ideas into consideration. So safety, trust, appreciation, respect. V stands for validation. Every human being wants to be validated. It doesn't mean you have to agree with me. Just go with me. Go walk with me in my experience and see where I'm coming from. E stands for encouragement. Everybody needs to feel like they're encouraged. Encouragement is a really cool word because it has the root word courage in it. Root word courage comes from the Latin word cor, the French word cur, which means heart. So to encourage somebody means you're in their heart. The best boss I've ever had knew what my dreams were, and he encouraged them, and he facilitated it. He's the guy that got me to be the youngest presenter at Franklin Covey. I was hired in his department, and I made a win-win agreement with him at Franklin Covey, and within 4 months, he had me moved to the department I wanted to be in so that I could become a trainer and a presenter, and he facilitated that. So encouragement's the sixth need, and the last need is dedication. Everybody needs to feel like the people around them are dedicated to them. If I go to your company and I'm standing in front of you and you answer the phone to somebody on the phone and you don't talk to me, I don't think you're dedicated to the walk-in client. You're dedicated to the phone-in client. So those seven needs spell starved, and the basic rule is when those needs are met, life is pretty good. We less smoke. When the needs aren't met, we start to starve. And the rule very simply is starved people starve people. When I don't feel safe, I'll probably disrespect you. When you're disrespected, you probably won't trust me. When you don't trust me, I'm not going to appreciate you. And we start to justify our fights with each other. And off we go. Fight or flight kicks in, and it's game on.
One of the characteristics I admire the most in people that I enjoy being around is a willingness to look in before they point out. It's something that is easy to have admiration for. It's easy to recognize what a benefit it is for people that first ask, what part of this do I own? Where am I included in this? How did I help create this problem? That's easy to admire. It's a little less easy to actually do it ourselves. So Matt talks about how it's important that we understand what it is that gets us going.
So one thing for sure you do is you have to know your needs, right? And so if you're being reactive, you got to figure it out. One of the things I found out is my dad was fairly reactive. I'm fairly reactive. And I didn't know why. Why am I so quick to react to somebody? What I found out is some of it's just my temperament. I'm sensitive. I'm high sensitive. So I pick up a lot of information really quickly. And so I tend to be going about 80 miles an hour. And then somebody slows me down, stops me, impedes me. And it forces me to always do more work in my head. So once I figured out why I'm more reactive, so that is the first thing I would do for anyone listening is start trying to understand your reactivity and don't project your reactivity on someone else's behavior.
So that makes sense, doesn't it? Understand your own reactivity and don't project that on others. That makes a lot of sense. What do you do when you're really busy? What do you do when you're feeling stress and those around you are coming and asking you to help them in areas that actually increase your likelihood of reacting to them? Now you may be thinking, that's not me. I am the picture of patience. But if we could talk to all of your employees, maybe they would sing a different tune. We often don't know until we go asking people what the interaction is like with us. So I asked Matt, what are some things that we can really do? Like, what are some tactical things that we can do when we have a tendency to jump on people?
Somebody comes in and they say, I need some help on this proposal. And you're like, oh my word, it's your job to write proposals. Go write the proposal. Have you thought it through? Have you worked on it? Have you done this? You don't need to answer. You don't need to ask me all these things. So I'm immediately jumping all over him. And part of it is because I'm probably already amped. I'm probably already an 8 or a 9. And then you want to interrupt me and add to my issue. What you might want to do instead is anticipate it, create some space for these things, do more training, more education, more development. A lot of times, if you're a highly reactive person or a more reactive person, you're more like the firefighter, right? Instead of the fire preventer. So we spend so much time just fighting the fire instead of anticipating, training, developing our people. Again, in most communities, in most businesses, we tend to hold the firefighter up in a way as much more valuable. We tend to promote the firefighter. It's much more glamorous. It's much more studly. It's much more romanticized than the fire preventer. And if you look into the lives of real firefighters, only 3% of the time are they actually fighting a fire. So 97% of the time, they're washing the truck, and they're training, and they're doing community development, and they're checking fire hydrants, and they're maintaining equipment. None of that's sexy. None of that's interesting. But once they hit the red lights and they're in the truck, everyone pays attention to them. And so part of that needs to be the life we create as leaders is don't compensate yourself for incredible reactivity. Some of that's just normal and natural. Compensate yourself for really good proactivity. Create space in your day, hours of deep time, deep thinking time, where you do deep work, right? And you take deeper dives in your systems, your structures, your processes. You anticipate when you're going to be most reactive, and you learn to maybe bring down your sensitivity before those times. It's just learning. It's just development. And it's also taking 100% responsibility for your own reaction. Once you own it, there is a thing that's really powerful that no one pays attention to called logical force. Logical force is where it's the energy to do something that's logical, even if it's immoral. But it's logical because you just made me mad. So in an argument, well, most people, when we get mad at each other and you just called me the worst thing you could call me, it's logical for me to ream you. It's logical for now me to go off on you. The problem with it is it's not moral. And so whether logical or not, if it's not moral, then I suffer later. Because now I'm becoming someone I'm not. But then if you ask these people why they did it, they try to justify, well, what am I supposed to do? Just let them walk all over me and call me all these names? Well, no, but do you feel good about it? You know that because take your most reactive moments. Anybody listening, go write down where you're most reactive, just the whole list of everything you do when someone ticks you off. And then let's just say at your funeral, your business partner gets up and reads all of those. You know, no one could go off and swear and kick and throw things against the wall like Gabe Shreve did. What a guy. That guy's the best partner I've ever seen. We don't ever want our most reactive moments out there. So don't logically try to justify it. If it's not your moral code, then try to use moral authority instead of logical force. And moral authority is knowing what your code is and building your own discipline to stay in it. Breathing, learning, scoping your life, slowing things down, telling them you'll get back to them before you respond, turning somebody away that's asking you a question, maybe coach them, you know, do the work with them.
I love the understanding of logical force. When something is not morally correct, but we make it correct because it makes logical sense. This idea that, well, you made me mad. You'll know if you're a person that has a tendency to use logical force by how many times you have to go back and make things right with others. Like if you have a track record of being the person that comes in and says, listen, I realize I was too intense. I'm sorry. If that's happening a lot, then you may want to look in the mirror and ask yourself the question, do I make things that appear logically okay, but morally not okay? Am I making them right? It's interesting to me, speaking to, you know, the foremost authority on relationships that I've ever met. It's interesting to me the correlation between our professional relationships and the people that we work with at work and how we work with them and the relationships that we have with people at home. I asked Matt, is there a leading reason? What causes people to become divorced?
I think most people divorce because they don't know any other way to do it. They don't know any other way. And what divorce is, if you think about it, it is the culmination of fight or flight when it's either got to go one of two ways. It's either going to get more violent emotionally or we have to go away. And so if we go away, divorce is the ultimate of going away. It does, by the way, I think there are perfect times to divorce. I don't think everyone should be married to the person they're married to. When you're losing your own dignity, what I usually teach is once you understand to not do the other behaviors that come with starving. Once you're starved, you tend to fall into a spiral of behavior. Those behaviors are things like selfishness, reactivity, polarization, negative interpretation, hopelessness, and abandonment. And so what I teach my people is before you ever divorce, be not selfish, be selfless. Learn to be selfless. Learn to be selfless at the expense of everything, but don't lose yourself. Be proactive, be unifying, not polarizing, be positively interpreting, asking the respecting question, be hopeful, and then make your decision. If you have to divorce, then divorce. But what you'll do is you'll do it with caring, you'll do it with love, you won't have the reactivity. Most people, I think, just don't know another way. And then another trick that is way powerful in the human mind is projection. Because if I'm starving, it's obviously you doing it to me. Because what I hear everywhere else is, I don't do this with anyone at work. I only do this with you. It's logical for me to only do this with you. But the funny thing about it is, marriage, I think, is the hardest relationship. Because there's not supposed to be a hierarchy. There's supposed to be an egalitarian and status. And most of us don't know how to work egalitarian very well. Especially if we are vulnerable. We know how to work as the boss. We know that power shift. We know how to work as the subordinate. We know that how to manage our children because they're under us. But husband-wife is an equal relationship, and there is also no one that you've let behind the curtain like this. Your boss doesn't know that you never put the toilet seat down and you have a hard time hitting the toilet in the middle of the night. He doesn't know that, but your wife does. And your husband knows things about you and your insecurities and sensitivities that no one else knows because you cover those at work. So I think it's the scariest relationship. I also think, by the way, it's the number one practice for spirituality and the number one practice for human development is in an intimate relationship. I think if you're constantly avoiding intimate, close relationships, you won't develop as fully because you need to have somebody that you are entirely vulnerable with. And you need to be able to risk that. That creates intimacy.
Man, I have talked about this many times, and you hear me laugh a little because I feel like I'm the poster child for the one that screws this part up. In fact, my work as a business coach, I would come to my office and I would work in these 30-minute power sessions with companies where I'm getting on with the business owner. We're diving right to the heart of the issue. You know, we're chasing out any limiting beliefs and we're working through ceilings of achievement and keeping people growth-minded. And I'm going from call to call like that. And I'm gaining speed as the day goes. I'm getting more and more intense. I'm feeling it more and more. And then I go home to the people in life that matter the most to me. And my wife will come in and she will say something like, "Oh, with our four kids, I just never get anything done." And I've spent an entire day chasing language like that out. And Coach Abe jumps all over that situation. And my wife says, "Don't coach me." And in no time mentally, I'm thinking, "Don't you know?" I'm embarrassed to say this. "Don't you know that people pay a lot of money?" Now, thankfully, I've never said that aloud to her. But the truth is, when we go home, they don't need Coach Abe. They need husband and father. In fact, we made up a code word. My wife will ask me the question, "Honey, are you in executive mode?" Which loosely translated is, "You're vomiting your stuff all over us. Can you join the family?" But it's asked in a high-minded question, so I'm less likely to be defensive. It's been really good for our family. There's something about being vulnerable in our most important relationships that just makes us a better person and a better partner.
One of the best things you can do to create vulnerability is, and this is going to sound crazy, this is Brené Brown to the core, but you share your secrets. You share them. I had an epiphany. I'm an obituary reader. Okay, so about twice a month, I'll read the obituaries, partially because it grounds me. It just totally grounds me. But a lot of people say, and he died in the arms of his family, surrounded by them in his hospital room. And I think of that and I'm like, oh boy, that sounds horrible. Like, oh, I mean, I don't want to be all slack jawed and open gaping mouth, but that's me. That's my vulnerability. But what I realized is every single one of us are going to be there. And the sooner we can start getting okay with it and admitting our flaws and admitting our weaknesses, you'll start to make vulnerability a part of your day. You don't need to dwell in it. You don't need to harp on it. But find what's the hardest thing to do and start telling people that. And I've been trying to do it more with my kids and show them where I'm insecure and show them what I'm afraid of. So kids are a great place to do that. I think your spouse would be a great place. But then there's a sacred duty that when someone reveals their vulnerability, Stephen Covey used to call it like, it's like holding their heart. It's sacred. And once they open that up to you, you must honor it. You must not hurt them with that information.
Vulnerability. It is the superpower of our day. And it's really difficult because there's this whole mental dialogue that goes along with, well, if I let my guard down, then they'll know that I'm nervous or that I'm scared or that I don't have the answer. And I think we all want to look good and we all want to be right. But vulnerability is the door that opens the way for us to connect with others. And there is a lot that we can do with partners at work and with our spouses, with our partners in life. There's a lot we can do when we're in sync with one another.
What's amazing is, like, as I say, one of the biggest reasons people divorce is they just don't know what else to do and they think they've tried everything. Is sometimes there's this magical moment when you're sitting with a couple and you've taught them to slow the conversation down. And we teach a bunch of tools, like 42 skills and stuff. And once they can start using some of the skills, there is the most beautiful moment where a couple is talking about something that causes pain and conflict. And there's a moment where the partner hears what she's saying and they hear it. It's almost like the first time they've heard it. And I always make them reflect back. So you feel blah, 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 blah. And what I always teach them is in that moment, ask yourself, do I care? So if I'm late for work, if I'm late from work coming home and I'm constantly late and my wife's constantly disappointed and we're having that conversation and she says, it just hurts. I feel like I can't trust you because you say you'll be home, but you're not coming home on time. And then I paraphrase that back. It's not just a nagging thing. You're hurt. Like, it's a trust issue now. You have a hard time trusting me. Is that what you're saying? I want you in that moment, in that space. And when I see it happen, I want you to kind of ask yourself, do I care? Do I care that my wife doesn't trust me now? And there's a moment when someone has that aha and they get in the high brain and they feel what the other person is sending. They're literally in sync with them. And that's called mirror neurons, right? So if I'm watching my wife tell me the story and she tears up because she can't trust me, and I am watching and I hear it and I tear up because she can't trust me, that's called synchrony. And that is human nature at its best. And you will literally see right then someone reach for the other. And when you see someone reach for the other and the other receives it, you can just feel healing in the room. And you don't need to say anything, but now they're really at one. They've got this closeness, this communion, this intimate communication. And there's something really cool the researchers have found that if you just look in your partner's eyes, your romantic partner's eyes, for 3 to 4 minutes, you don't say anything, you don't touch, you just try to connect. You can even ask yourself a question like, what is it like to be her? What is it like to be him? If you do that for 3 to 4 minutes, within 3 to 4 minutes, your hearts will fall into sync. Your hearts will beat in rhythm. And in sync, even at the same rate, you adjust. And that adjustment is happening on a physiological level. But when it happens emotionally, it's powerful. And I see that all the time. So a third of my clients are on the verge of divorce. And 75 to 80% of those turn it around because No one has more will than they do. They just don't know how. And once we get them in and they can start having these experiences where they can literally reach for the other in a synchronized way, then what happens is now you can hold me where I am not, where I feel vulnerable. Like that wife could help the husband who was 15 years old and learned to detach. And she could hold him and bring him back in and make sure he belongs. And he could do the same thing for her. So it's real. It happens. And it's learnable. It's just, interestingly, it's incredibly natural. You do it with your kids all the time. But you have a harder time doing it on an egalitarian front with the one that you vowed everything to. So some of it is just you literally shutting your mouth and connecting eye to eye and actually being influenceable to what they're saying.
I love Matt's use of the word influenceable. Shutting your mouth, be connected eye to eye, be influenceable. Ask the high-minded question, what's it like for this person right now to be with me? And that leads us to incredible places where we can focus on each other's strengths. We can help build each other up. We don't hold each other hostage to what we think they're thinking or what we think their motive is for saying something a certain way or doing something a certain way. We kind of get back to what is it about us that works, not just highlighting what feels broken in the moment.
There's not another relationship that has more expectations, right? Your wife needs, or spouse needs to be your lover, your best friend, your confidant, a financial manager, bringing home the money, a parent. Like everything is hinged on this one decision. So another thing you could just naturally do is assume they're not going to be good at everything, just a few things. And then let's build each other up and train each other up to do the other thing.
Matt is one of my favorite people on earth. I feel like it's been an incredible blessing to know him. Again, I want to really challenge you to get a hold of his book, Starved Stuff. You can find that at matttownsend.com. You can also get it on Amazon. It has changed the way that I communicate, both in the professional workplace and at home. I love how Matt distills down the 7 basic needs that every human relationship needs: safety, trust, appreciation, respect, validation, encouragement, dedication. I love the understanding that he brings about the challenges that we create when we work with one another in the reactive brain. When we are talking about deep, intense issues and we're in the amygdala and we're chemically prepared for fight, we're not going to come together. And I also love the importance that Matt places on what relationships can do for us, especially what our most intimate relationships can do. It is the place that we can be our very best. If we will learn some skills, if we will lean into the difficulty of coming together and learning how to understand the other person, it feels like we should know all that because we fell in love once, but nothing in life is like that. Everything worth doing requires the development of skills and practice and failure and admitting when we're wrong and just owning that. Well, there you have it, folks. I hope you've enjoyed our time together, and I hope you'll join us next time as we continue to explore the stories of extraordinary individuals who choose difficult.